It's time for Senior Talk with Carol Higgins Taylor, a show designed with seniors in mind. Carol discusses everything from Social Security to senior housing, medications to Medicare, and so much more. And now, your award-winning host, Carol Higgins Taylor.
Hi, and thank you for joining me today for this edition of Senior Talk. Last week, we had Dr. Clifford Singer on the show and Christy Miner talking about clinical trials that are happening at Acadia Hospital, and we're going to continue that conversation today. Someone in the United States develops Alzheimer's every 65 seconds. I think that is staggering. So if ever there was a time to do research into this disease, clearly it is now. Dr. Singer, thank you for staying to do another show. Your work is fascinating. And Christy, thank you for being here still.
Thank you, Kara.
So the clinical trials, let's do a brief overview in case people didn't hear last week. What you're doing with these, and this specific trial is for people who do not have symptoms, are not symptomatic for dementia or Alzheimer's, correct?
That's right. We have two studies. The one we're mostly focusing on today, it's called the Early Study. This is for people who either have a first-degree relative, a parent, or a sibling with Alzheimer's disease, and they themselves are worried about getting Alzheimer's disease, and they may, in fact, be at very high risk. And they're over 60. They're between 60 and 65 years of age. If they're over 65, they can just be screened. They have to have normal memory function for their age, and, aging affects short-term memory, but there is a range of normal, at which point they have to pass a screen for that. And then they get a special kind of brain scan called a PET scan that shows whether they're developing amyloid plaques in their brains, which puts them at very high risk for developing cognitive impairment and dementia from Alzheimer's disease. So if they have normal for age memory and they have evidence of amyloid deposition in the brain, then they are and they're otherwise healthy, they are eligible for the study.
And as we talked about last week, it's a 5-year study. They take a medication. It's double blind. So they might get a placebo. They might not.
Yeah.
And then they're monitored very carefully.
Yep.
So
over time to see what proportion of people develop cognitive symptoms over that 5-year period of time. And we're hoping, of course, that this that the oral medication, the experimental medication that they take, which shuts down production of beta amyloid, we're hoping that this slows transition or even prevents transition to cognitive impairment over time.
So the end result of this, you're hoping at the end of your study, that this medication will prove so successful that it could perhaps be given to people who have this plaque and may prevent them developing Alzheimer's in general.
Yeah, the model is, the hope is that we could make Alzheimer's disease sort of a chronic condition or risk for Alzheimer's disease, kind of a chronic but manageable condition, manageable with diet and exercise and perhaps different forms of medical interventions, oral medication or immunotherapy, infused antibodies that can control either amyloid plaque buildup or the development of tau protein, which is the flip side of the Alzheimer pathologic cascade. So amyloid comes first, then the development of tau tangles. You've heard of plaques and tangles of Alzheimer's disease. The plaque is amyloid. The tau is tangles. Once you have tau, you're developing symptoms. There's been some damage to the brain. We're hoping that by controlling amyloid plaque development that we can prevent the development of tau. We're studying both amyloid and tau aspects of Alzheimer's disease in the hope of preventing or slowing progression of the disease.
Is there a way to reverse the tangles if they're not too severe?
Good question. We don't know yet. We are starting studies of immunotherapy antibodies targeting tau, and hopefully we can at least stop its progression. We don't know if you can reverse we're unlikely to be able to reverse the tau that's already there, but we can hopefully stop the progression. we know we're not able to reverse the damage already done to the brain. So once people have symptoms, the primary hope is that we can stop progression of the disease. We do have medications we can prescribe. You know, you can just go to your doctor and get Aricept or Namenda, medications that can support brain function and maybe produce a little bit of improvement, occasionally pretty good improvement. But those medications that can be prescribed now do not affect the underlying disease process itself. This we don't have anything we can do for that medically. That's just these experimental interventions that we're hoping can slow the underlying disease process. But as we mentioned in the first segment, we know that a healthy diet, plenty of exercise, sleep, and stress reduction are things that we think can really slow the progression too of cognitive impairment.
What do you think about, along with the diet, exercise, and sleeping, the mental stimulation? People talk about puzzles and crossword or learning a new language or an instrument. Is that really helpful, and what are the best ones to do?
Well, the data, the scientific data, are a little mixed about that. We think that doing cognitive tests, you know, crossword puzzles, Sudoku, jigsaw puzzles, and the computer-based games like Lumosity, we think those things can certainly help mental functions that you're exercising with that particular game. If it's a memory game, if it's a concentration game, it might help reaction time, concentration, or memory, but may not generalize to other brain functions in the same way that diet, exercise, and sleep generalize to overall brain health. Now, there's some data, some studies that do suggest overlapping benefit from cognitive stimulation. I would say that staying mentally, cognitively active and engaged, especially socially engaged with other people or with other people, that this all can have potential benefit in overall brain health. But we don't have as strong data for that. But it is very, very, very likely that social interaction is important as well. As cognitive stimulation, so we certainly encourage people to do that, especially if they, especially if it's social, and especially if they enjoy it. You know what? One of the most time and time again, studies show that dancing
really
is one of the most effective ways to keep your brain healthy. Yeah, and the way I think about it is because it involves social interaction, fun, physical activity, and to some degree cognitive activity, because you have to think about what you have to do next.
So when you do this, you're actually keeping your brain healthier. Will that in itself, if you're starting to have plaque, will that in itself, and you may not know this, but will that stop the plaque from increasing? It won't scrub it away, but will it keep it from getting worse?
No,
or is that what you're trying to find out?
Well, no, we don't think these activities and socialization and so forth can help slow the progression of amyloid plaque. What we do think it does, though, is it helps build brain reserve, cognitive reserve, so that you can better tolerate or withstand the damage that's being done by the amyloid plaque and the tau tangles. So we've known for many years that people with well-educated people have more resistance to Alzheimer's disease. Now, they still get it, but they may get it a year or two later. So we know other things, that people who are physically active and have these diets also have more cognitive reserve, and it may be true of dancing and socialization as well, helps maintain cognitive reserve, but doesn't actually slow the underlying disease itself. That's why we're looking at these experimental interventions that hopefully will be able to be given more broadly to reduce the progression of Alzheimer's disease.
You are doing other studies as well.
Yeah, we're not just looking at prevention of people aimed at people with normal memory function. We're not just looking at those people. We also have promising research studies for people who already have memory symptoms, the earliest symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, called mild cognitive impairment or mild neurocognitive disorder. There are two terms for the same thing. These are people who have very early Alzheimer's disease and then have memory symptoms, but they do not yet have dementia. And we're looking at interventions that may slow the progression to dementia.
When we come back, I want to talk about what those symptoms are and what that means, because I've known enough seniors who, the minute they lose their keys, they make that leap from this is the beginning of the end, when really they just misplaced their keys. But they get very nervous about this. Stay with us. We'll be right back right after this. If you would like to hear this show in podcast form, log on to WVOMFM.com and you'll find it there. Hi, we're back with Senior Talk. So when we left, we talked about mild cognitive symptoms. And what would you call a mild cognitive symptom? What is memory loss and what is just, you know, mainstream, maybe I forgot what I did with something?
Yeah, you know, clinically we define mild cognitive impairment as the early stage of Alzheimer's disease and other causes of dementia, but it's got a fairly rigid definition that you're performing in the lowest 10th percentile of your age group. And it has to be age adjusted because aging itself does cause some forgetfulness. The primary things about mental function with age that happen is, first of all, word-finding difficulty. Nouns and names are more elusive as we age, and it starts early in life. Starts in the 30s.
Swell.
Gets a little worse over time. Does not progress to dementia. It's not a marker for dementia. It is a nuisance. It is a marker of aging, but it's not necessarily a prelude to dementia until it starts to get really bad. And then something, the encoding of episodes or events in one's life. So forgetting conversations, forgetting what you have to do, anticipatory memory. These are very age-sensitive things as well. Our memories are not as sticky as we get older as they are when we are young. In order to remember where you parked your car, where you put your keys, you have to actually think what you're doing when you're putting your keys away. You actually have to think about parking your car. When someone is talking to you or telling you their name, if you want to remember their name, you really have to think about it. You have to activate the frontal portion of your brain, the frontal lobes. You have to turn them on, light them up, if you're going to remember. When you're young, your memory just, kids remember stuff. They can multitask. There can be a lot going on. They're taking it all in. As you get older, you cannot multitask and hope to remember. You have to focus to give a little boost to the memory center of the brain.
So when one spouse says to another, you don't remember anything I say, it may be they're just not really listening or focusing on. It's not that they may have dementia.
It may not be that they have dementia or they're developing dementia. It could just be normal aging, which makes memory less efficient. But that doesn't mean there isn't things that they can do about it or that there may be other things going on. Sleep deprivation is another big factor for inefficient memory. There are vitamin deficiencies, nutritional deficiencies. There are medical issues and medications people might be taking that might make memory less efficient, make people more forgetful. And there's distractedness and inattention. As I mentioned, you really have to focus if you want to remember something. So inattentiveness is a big cause, and that may be what's happening in the example you mentioned between a married couple. When you start to get worried that there's another process, when is the early symptom of Alzheimer's disease something to be concerned about? When this is getting noticeably worse over a period of months, and when people are forgetting more consistently and they're forgetting more significant things.
Give me an example of this.
early on, they just repeatedly asked the same question. I think you can ask the same question twice and forget and attribute it to it not paying attention. If you ask the same question three times in the course of 24 hours, you know, I think that's a marker. And if it happens, you know, repeatedly over time, there's something going on. If a person gets confused, develops geographic confusion, if they are starting to get lost in familiar places or a little befuddled about where to turn to get home or where to go to or how to get to a familiar place, that's a concern. If a person starts to have trouble managing their finances, that's a concern. So it's a little bit of deviation from the routine. Especially when judgment and reasoning ability starts to get involved, because that tells you that the disease, for example, Alzheimer's disease, is moving into a different part of the brain, is going to cause functional problems in day-to-day functioning. And that's when mild cognitive impairment, which is mostly just memory, impaired memory, starts to transition into dementia, when the disease is moving into the frontal areas of the brain. And thinking ability is affected. So that's when you really have to get concerned. This is not normal aging. Normal aging does not cause problems with thinking and reasoning ability.
And I was going to ask you about that. What is normal memory loss with aging? What does that constitute?
Well, you know, misplacing things or having trouble with names and nouns or occasionally forgetting conversations. But when it's routine and getting more severe, particularly over the course of months, and a person's personality and abilities are really changing, that's the transition from normal aging to a disease process.
When we come back, we will talk about what you can do if you're starting to see these symptoms, what's the best course of action, and a little bit more about the clinical trials, so stay with us. Number to call, 973-6986. Hi, we're back with Senior Talk. The number to call if you are interested in one of these clinical trials, which really sounds like a great idea, 973-6986, 973-6986. Dr. Singer, normal aging, you've mentioned it a few times. What constitutes normal forgetfulness as you age?
Well, forgetting events that happen, it's called episodic memory. So our memories become less efficient in encoding conversations or things that happen to you during the course of the day. We also aren't as efficient in anticipatory memory, remembering what we're supposed to be doing. The main thing people notice is problems recalling names and nouns, name of objects. So names of people and names of objects. And that becomes a real nuisance. You remember it, but you remember it the next day. I mean, or you remember it with cueing. Coming up with a person's name can be very challenging after a certain age. But, you know, if you remember their initials, for example, it will come to you.
And is this something that would start, say, in the 60s and then get progressively, so by the time you're late 80s?
It starts earlier in life. It starts in the 30s, but by the time you're in your 50s or 60s, it's noticeable and annoying. Not necessarily predictive of dementia, of developing dementia.
And it could be a wide variety of things, I think you mentioned, that could cause
memory
loss.
That's right.
And these other research studies that you have, if someone has been diagnosed, they could enter a study too, because there's quite a few of them going on.
Yeah, we have a fairly robust program for Alzheimer's-related research, including these two studies for people who do not yet have symptoms, but we're hoping we can prevent the development of symptoms. We also have studies for people with mild cognitive impairment, people who have some memory impairment but do not yet have dementia. And we're hoping that these experimental interventions can prevent the progression to dementia over time. And we even have a couple of studies for people who already have mild dementia that we hope we can improve their memory function and thinking abilities.
So if someone wanted to be a part of this but they're afraid, we talked a little bit in the last show, I think maybe even during the break, about learning early, finding out as soon as you can, being diagnosed early, that's a really personal decision. But do you think that that is the best thing to do? Because then they can start early treatment or clinical trials or intervention in some way?
Well, we can't say this is the right thing for everybody. And we do assess a person's ability to hear that they have a positive PET scan and are at very high risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. We assess that before they have their scan. After they have their scan, if it's positive, then we assess their reaction to that, make sure they understand what that means. It's not a diagnosis. It's just tells us that they're at very high risk. So it's important information to have, and we think people should know what their risk is, and so that they have the option of participating in clinical research or knowing what the science tells us about things that can help prevent progression of Alzheimer's disease to dementia. Are there things that they can do, like we talked about, diet and exercise and so forth? If they already have symptoms, people are terrified of the term Alzheimer's disease. And you know, in the clinical setting, when we determine that a person has some dementia or significant cognitive impairment, and we think it's from Alzheimer's disease, we sort of evaluate whether they are ready to hear the term or whether the family is ready to hear the term. As it turns out, most people want to know. They want to know specifically what this is. Is this Alzheimer's disease? Is this another process? I think that families deserve and should know what disease is causing the dementia in a particular person. If it's Alzheimer's disease, they need to know that. They need to know what their genetic and family history is. And so that they can pay close attention to the research.
Well, if someone has critical heart disease or diabetes or something else going on, doctors would tell them, these are your risk factors. This is what you have. This is a very big deal. And yet with Alzheimer's, is it because there's really no cure? Or is there a stigma attached? Why aren't doctors so readily eager to say, this is the deal?
Yeah, all those reasons. First of all, Alzheimer's disease is a stigmatizing diagnosis for a lot of people. Second of all, a lot of doctors aren't sure whether it's Alzheimer's disease or not, so they fall back on just calling it dementia. Third of all, they don't really know what to do when, in fact, there's a lot of things to do.
And that's the key. That's the key right there. There are really a lot of things that you can do.
Yes.
And the best way to find out what those things are is to call 973-6986, 973-6986. Talk to Christy Miner. Get in a trial. That's it for me. This is Senior Talk. Thanks so much for listening, Dr. Singer. Christy, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.